Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners from Zimbabwe, Russia, and England will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us human rights stories that are too often missed by mainstream media. Why journalists are dying in Russia. How the power of love is conquering the love of power. And where unions are taking on government and winning. I'm Chris Richards, and I'm joined today by my friend and colleague David Ransom, who, like me, is a co-editor of New Internationalist magazine. This year is the 60th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. It's also the year that Olympic medals are going to get won and lost in Beijing, so the New Internationalist Collective decided to hand out a few medals of its own, human rights medals. You were the umpire, David. Are human rights winning, do you think?
Well, yes and no. We've done this several times before when the Olympics run, and before we used to look at governments and we gave good marks or bad marks and medals to governments, but this time we felt, well, we really couldn't do that for various reasons, but it was much more appropriate to give medals to particular groups who are in some way representative of a whole mass of people who are really active in a positive sense on human rights around the world, and that is very much a cause for celebration.
Indeed. If the torture of a single person could save the lives of a thousand others, do you think it would be justified?
No. You know, it's the kind of academic argument that people have. In theory, it sounds like a good idea, but in practice, it doesn't work. People don't believe it. But actually, when you look at it hard to see if the torture of anybody has saved a single life, has prevented a single suicide bomb, has done any of the kinds of things that people justify torture with, and they're increasingly trying to find ways of justifying it, it doesn't actually work.
Really? Because if you listen to the British government and the US government, you'd think that...
You'd believe, yes, people have got into this sort of habit, particularly in the US, where they're trying to redefine what torture is and excluding certain things, which are obviously torture from what they really are, that it's needed because it produces results. And people keep coming up with theoretical situations, you know, when the lives of dozens of children are at stake, and if you torture somebody, you get the information that's going to save their lives. But those actual situations never actually happen. And when you really push people to extremes and ask them to provide evidence of where torture has ever done any such thing, they can't actually do it.
Mm. And this is why some people say that the war on terror has become a war of terror, with torture, arbitrary detention, death. It's ironic, isn't it? Its main supporters were actually the countries that drove through the Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, countries like Britain and the United States. Why the change in direction of government, David?
Well, it's this curious ambivalence, if you like, that actually there is a lot to celebrate, certainly since the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was produced in 1948. There has been real progress, and a lot of that progress has happened because of the kinds of pressures that were put on governments. And in many ways, a lot of, certainly if you take a place like Latin America, the abuse of human rights in Latin America is a lot less now than it was. What's happened since the war on terror, more specifically, though, is that suddenly governments have changed directions. The first time, really, since 1948, when there has been a backwards step from governments. Before, it was reluctant governments being pushed into recognizing human rights and legislating for them eventually. Now they're backtracking on that. Now, explaining it out of any other terms than the sudden kind of convulsion of 9/11 is a little difficult to do. That's certainly the most obvious reason why it's thought to be justified, because people feel, or those governments, people in power, feel that the only way that they can deal with the threats posed by this war on terror, which they have declared, is by simply abandoning a lot of the fundamental principles behind human rights. And that's happening in the UK just as much as it is in the States. And in those sort of English-speaking countries that make great play of their defence of human rights and human rights as a critical element in democratic societies.
I see that the United States is still massively in arrears in making its levy towards United Nations operations. As at 30th of November, it still owed nearly $700 million, but that was down from $1.3 billion in 2005. What's your view, David? Is the United States just turning its back on the whole concept of human rights now?
Well, it's the unilateralist approach. I mean, one should say that actually the failure of the United States to pay its dues to the UN is an issue, an ongoing issue. And of course, no one has ever been kicked out of the United Nations for not paying their dues, at least not yet. But it's certainly a reflection of the unilateralist view of the current administration in the United States, that the UN is a sort of either an irrelevance or potentially a rival to its own position. And as one's seen repeatedly throughout the conduct of this war on terror, it's basically seen as a way of exercising American power in the American century. And so the UN takes very much a back seat. In people like John Bolton, when he was the US representative of the UN, you have people who are openly hostile to the whole venture, really. Mm. And that is then reflected in a lot of the things that the UN has responsibilities for, amongst which is the Universal Declaration on Human Rights.
So let's go to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for a bit of inspiration. The Human Rights Medal winners. Article 2 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration without distinction of any kind, such as race, colour, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth or other status. It's a pretty long list, isn't it? The United Nations Human Rights Committee says this includes who and how we love. So the new Internationalist Gold Medal for the Happiness of the Individual has been awarded to the Equality Foundation and Campaign Against Homophobia in Poland. Can you run us through the background of that, David?
Again, a sort of an ambiguous situation that certainly since with all the political developments in Eastern Europe, it's been one of those issues, sex rights, if you like, that appear to be unfamiliar and driven by Western concerns or whatever, and has arisen quite sharply in Poland, Latvia, a lot of those relatively new members of the European Union. But of course, the lesbian, gay, transgender community exists there in much the same way as exists elsewhere, and they've become much more active. And in a curious way, by the nature of their activities, they have actually brought this issue to prominence that actually, I think it's fair to say, has much broader resonance than that community. In some ways, those communities are now speaking to a much wider community about the general attitude towards human rights in some of those countries. And so, for all that the situation is very difficult for a lot of people from those communities, considerable progress is being made as a result. So it is another example of where people who become active around basic human rights actually succeed in pushing things forward, not just for themselves, but for a lot of other people as well.
So how did you come to award these medals, David? What were the criterion and what were the categories in which you awarded them?
We started with one basic principle, which was that it's, if you like, the social and economic rights that are there in the Universal Declaration that have been the most neglected. And we'd look for groups that were particularly active on some of those. Then we had to accept that if we gave them to just five or six groups, and groups rather than individuals, it was bound to be a little bit hit or miss. So what we actually did was to talk to Amnesty and a variety of other groups about groups that they felt were in particular need of support and under a certain degree of stress. And so we gradually whittled it down to this kind of numbers and tried to cover across the range of social, economic, cultural rights. And that took us to sex rights in Eastern Europe, women in Zimbabwe, although incidentally women in Zimbabwe also involves men. And one group that came to us quite separately is the issue of trade union rights. As we know at the moment, the trade unions have been facing great difficulties in Western countries for some time. But around the world, the struggle for trade union rights continue, and a particular example came to us from Iran and the bus drivers there, which was particularly inspiring and gave a different insight into the situation in Iran than one might get elsewhere. And another long-standing issue was Bhopal and the terrible catastrophe that there was in Bhopal several decades ago, and the fact that the communities there have been struggling ever since to get proper compensation and recognition of what they have suffered to enable them to continue their lives. So we looked for quite a wide range, and finally finished up with water rights, which of course are a major issue in every sense, and picked on a group, this one in Nepal, partly because there's an interesting political situation in Nepal at the moment and hopefully more potential for those groups to make some headway. And they particularly had a successful fight against the privatisation of their water supply system in Kathmandu.
Well, let's go now to some of these human rights medals winners and hear a little bit more from them about what actually has led to their campaigns and the political background and how they're actually doing their work. I was particularly struck by the Women of Zimbabwe Arise, or was it, David? Article 21 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, "Everyone has the right to take part in the government of his country. Yet the closest that most of us get to this is a ballot box every 3 or 4 years, but not the good women of WASA, short for Women of Zimbabwe Arise. It's urging Zimbabwe's women to come forward and very vocally put their views. Its national coordinator is Jenny Williams. Why was WASA formed, Jenny?
Well, it was formed precisely, as you mentioned in the introduction, is to give women a platform to speak out about the issues of governance, about everyday issues in their lives. But it was also formed at a time when there was a raft of repressive legislation in Zimbabwe that had silenced any critical view of the government. And so we felt that we had to have a mandate of civil disobedience, a strategic nonviolent protest, and we had to be highly visible, being courageous in the street and speaking out about our issues that affect day-to-day life in Zimbabwe.
WASA's conducted 50 protests in its first 3 years, and over 2,500 WASA women spent time in police custody during those protests. You've marched on a number of authorities and on shops that aren't providing affordable food. Tell us about some of WASA's most successful actions, Jenny.
Well, I think we've now been 5 years in operation, and I think our number of protests are probably heading over 100 protests. But I think the most memorable period that we have had has been in the last 3 months. We partnered with a research organization and we prepared an analysis of political violence suffered by our members. And we named who the perpetrators of that violence was. And in October, we launched a report outlining this violence. We then decided that we would take those reports en masse directly to the Zimbabwe Republic Police, who are the main perpetrators of violence against WASA members in the peaceful protests. And we had demonstrations directly to 3 of the police headquarters. It has been quite profound that when you confront someone directly with their evil deeds, that they very often are too embarrassed to actually look you in the face. And we found that we never spent a night in custody, and most of us were released without being tortured that day. So it was a sign, that our direct confrontational approach hit the nail right on the head. And since then, although we haven't spent time in custody, there's been a now more underhanded way of trying to deal with us, trying to stop us from protesting. So although we haven't been arrested, we have had members abducted from their homes, and it has signaled a change in the way the police are viewing us to possibly something that is actually more evil, with abductions and threats directly on members' lives.
Jenny, that's very dangerous work. How do you get women to participate in actions when, for instance, they've never protested before?
Well, we do a lot of community meetings where we discuss issues. We do a lot of training in strategic nonviolence. We also try to look at the nature and the character of us as African women and find ways that we can, within our characteristics, the way we are, within our culture, we can find ways to hold this government accountable. We also look at our creativity and our femininity. We look at our opportunities and our weaknesses, what we're strong at, and we find ways to build all of those into the style of protest that you have seen, marching on Valentine's Day with red roses saying, "It's time to learn to love again, Zimbabweans." And because we blend that femininity, that nonviolence, and that creativity, we find that we as a leadership of the organization actually are not coping enough with the demand for us to recruit new members, the demand to open up new areas. There are just not enough hours in the day for us to to answer all the calls for our organisation and its style of work.
I could imagine. I'm wondering, when you say that you've been developing your strong characteristics, how do you actually locate them? And then how do you bring them to the surface and actually work with them?
We really just, in community meetings, we'll talk about what we know best, what our role as mothers are, what our role as women is, what we want for our children, what we need in daily existence. And we talk about what are our individual strengths. We are a community-based organization, so very, very few of our members can say they are highly intellectual or have degrees in such and such. We mostly look for our degrees in common sense, our degrees in strengths that as a parent you must do the best for your child. And I think when we bring things back down to such a basic level, we are capable of getting ordinary people to do extraordinary things.
I'd like to bring David Ransom into our conversation now. David, it sounds no-nonsense and effective. I'm wondering how you think this kind of work would work where you live.
I'm full of admiration. I mean, one has to feel humble in front of people who face dangers of a kind that we don't here. But oddly enough, it's sort of inspirational for the way we work here as well, because actually in my local community in Bristol, there are major issues in that city as well. And actually the point that Jenny was making about when you actually confront people who are responsible with the truth and they know it, they don't look you in the eye. It's that kind of sense, and also bringing out the strength that there is in local communities in ordinary people who don't feel they need to have a degree in this, that or the other to say anything. Those are just key things all over the world, I think. And it's fantastic to hear what's possible to do even in such extraordinarily difficult circumstances that there obviously are in Zimbabwe at the moment.
Absolutely. Jenny, you were talking about your action with the police and that as a consequence some of your members are being abducted at the moment. Has the action that you've taken also divided the police force? Are you finding that some members of the police force are actually turning and actually siding with you whilst others remain entrenched in their current position?
Most definitely. You know, this has also been another very successful way in which we have worked, because we are ordinary members who do not expect to have political office, and our agenda is just everyday basic issues. We are also recognized by the Zimbabwe Republic Police, by the Central Intelligence Agency, as representing their issues, that they are not free because of the uniform, because they are in the employ of the dictator Robert Mugabe. They cannot speak out about those issues. And so very often when we are in custody, we regard ourselves as being facilitators of a workshop on life and how to speak out nonviolently. And we do joke about that. We say when we're in custody that we will be conducting a workshop for police officers in how to speak out and how to hold this government accountable. And it is extremely effective. We also use a symbol in the work that we do. We hold our forefinger up and our thumb down, making the shape of an L for love. And we keep saying to police officers, we are striking you with our love. It is because of you that we do the work that we do. And so we continue to be arrested, and you can continue to be faced with the dilemma. Do you just arrest us? Do you allow us to go free? Or do you beat us? Do you torture us? But it is on your conscience that you act, and you should recognize that we are representing your needs.
I'm wondering, on reflection, Jenny, do you think that nonviolent action is easier for women than it is for men? I mean, what you've just described is extraordinary, and it takes very brave people to do it. But I'm wondering whether there is some safety in being women as compared to men. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, yes, I am obviously also a gender activist, but they do say that violence is the weapon of the weak. And I think whether you are male or female, if you are weak, you will resort to violence. But I think it is a matter of enlightenment. If you put in the hands of someone the methods of strategic nonviolence to localize that their rights are God-given rights and no one can take them away, and you give them that tool to empower themselves, and then you are able to pull in solidarity from other people in the area, it strengthens someone and it makes them feel confident that strategic nonviolence is the way. You know, one of the most incredible things in our organization is the solidarity that we build. In my very first arrest in 2003, the police officers wanted to arrest me alone. And very soon there were over 100 women demanding to be arrested alongside me and saying that it yes. wasn't a matter of my rights, it was a matter of everyone's rights. Mm. And that is a style that has continued throughout the 5 years, where we all go and hand ourselves in, and the police just don't know how to respond to that.
Mm. You were saying before that your actions are based on day-to-day problems that you're facing as communities, but you've also sought a place at the negotiating table between the government of Zimbabwe, the government of South Africa, and members of the Southern African Development Community. Why was that, Jenny?
We know that the Southern African Development Committee, SADC, saw events in Zimbabwe and appointed the government of Thabo Mbeki to be involved in a mediation with the opposing sides in the Zimbabwean conflict. Civic voices were not included, and we felt that if it is just politicians, they will talk about political power and they will not look at socio-economic rights, socio-economic issues. And so we had demonstrations. I led a demonstration to the South African embassy in Harare saying that you must address our socio-economic issues and you cannot solely talk on political power. And I think as a result of that, we were able to force space for a civic platform to be engaged by the mediation. You know, unfortunately, the mediation has continued in secret and basically has been stillborn, which is why we see that Robert Mugabe has called for an election in March, and we know that he has poo-pooed the attempts of Thabo Mbeki and SADC to resolve the crisis. So we remain committed to ensuring that a definite, open, transparent dialogue with all civic and political parties should be engaged if there is going to be a proper resolution. The election coming up on the 29th of March is not an election that will involve the people of Zimbabwe. It will only be an election for the politicians to continue to be in power, and nothing will change.
Okay. Jenny, when we spoke yesterday, you hadn't been to bed and it was 6 o'clock in the morning. Can you tell us about what you're up to at the moment? What was involving you that you actually were unable to go to bed last night?
Okay, as I mentioned, there is an election coming around, and we have a campaign that we have started. Our campaign is to provoke Zimbabweans to do something extraordinary around this election process. And to do that, we have selected the face of a child. We have said if you look at a child, no matter how hungry they are, no matter how bad things are, they can always smile. So we have a campaign that we are rolling out called Stand Up for Your Child, and we have a visual of the face of a child smiling. And we are hoping that as we roll out the flyers and posters countrywide, people will see the sight of this child. They will recognize that as a parent, they have now got to do something special in order to make a future for their children. So we were on a countrywide tour to deliver our posters, our flyers of that campaign to our different constituencies, to our different chapters of the organization, and that involved doing it over a 48-hour period. We're very excited about the campaign because we feel that the face of a child will also shatter a zone of indifference of people in Zimbabwe who are saying that the political crisis has nothing to do with me, I just want to feed my family and I don't want to engage in the political crisis at all. And we hope that the campaign will be as successful as all the other campaigns that we have done around the election period.
And we too hope that it is successful. It's extraordinary work, Jenny, and it's certainly a privilege to be talking with you today. That was Jenny Williams, who's the National Coordinator of Women of Zimbabwe Arise, or WOZA. Jenny, I'm sure that some of our friends who are listening will want to find out more information about your work. Where can we direct them to go? Is there a website, for instance, that they can find out more?
Yes, our website is www.wozazimbabwe.org.
Jenny, it was a privilege to talk to you. Thank you very much for being part of our program today.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate the solidarity from people around the world. It is very important to us.
You certainly deserve it. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today we're awarding medals in the Human Rights Olympics with New Internationalist co-editor David Ransom. Human rights value life. Its biggest violator is death. States sponsor death through making laws like making abortion illegal. In Latin America, 4 million abortions take place each year, and most of them are illegal. 5,000 women are dying each year from complications. Tell us about Martha Saleh, David.
Well, she was a remarkable woman who contracted cancer when she was pregnant and who was denied treatment on the basis that the treatment would have resulted in the termination of the pregnancy. So she continued with the pregnancy and died shortly after the birth. But before that happened, she campaigned vigorously within Colombia, where there was some movement on women's right to choose. And I think most people accept that the nature of that campaign that she ran or she was involved with had a major effect in not entirely legalizing abortion in Colombia, but easing the circumstances so that it would be possible in those kinds of circumstances for the woman to choose. It's an extraordinarily moving and complicated story because, of course, the daughter is alive and well, and the family have their own feelings and views about it. But the courage of that woman in very, very difficult circumstances, not just personal, but in a country and on the continent where women's rights to choose is only broadly accepted in two countries, that's Cuba and Guyana, to have the courage to offend the church, to offend a lot of the established cultural norms in those societies while undergoing the kind of ordeal that she was just incredible, and it had an amazing effect.
So she was effectively dying while she was campaigning. She had cancer, yeah. And she couldn't be treated because it would kill the child. So
that's right.
We must be talking enormous levels of pain here while she's actually campaigning.
Yes, indeed so. There's a very beautifully written story in the magazine version of this, and in a way, it's in the telling of the story. You get the full dimension of what an extraordinarily courageous and difficult task she undertook and what a positive outcome there was. With the support, she had some elder children as well. And she was living in extremely difficult circumstances with virtually no income at the best of times. And she continued pretty much up until the end. And the reporter who did the story followed her right through and writes very, very movingly about the experience of what that meant.
It certainly was a moving article. There's another group of articles about death in the magazine as well, David. I mean, 20,000 people on death row when you were researching human rights winners. What does taking a life for a life say about countries, do you think?
We have somebody writing from death row in the United States. And, of course, it's been the case that for many human rights groups, the complete abolition of the death penalty remains a basic fundamental principle on which they are all agreed. To some extent, it has been reduced over the years, but it still persists. And there's somebody on death row in Georgia who's written for New Internationalist magazine for some time, explaining some of the ramifications of this that actually go quite a bit beyond that. Now, as you'll be familiar, in the United States, there is actually quite a strong abolition of the death penalty movement. Brandon Astor Jones, who writes for us, explains the strange feeling that he has that it's easier to campaign on that issue than it is for people who are unjustly imprisoned. And the absence of an effective system of justice in the United States. And it's really quite moving that he should be in his circumstances where he faces the death penalty and he writes for us as if it were his last testament and he never quite knows when it's going to happen, that he should consider this. Now, what he actually also feels is that the death penalty is still in the United States symbolic of lynchings and a particular political attitude. And that certainly the black communities in the United States feel that to be the case. And so the argument against the death penalty is part and parcel of an argument against the way the judicial system in the United States operates. But actually, in his case, he writes more about music and Strange Fruit, the extraordinary song that was written about the death penalty. And he blends these all together in what amounts to, from somebody who's actually faced the death penalty and its use on himself for many years, a very moving, to my mind, an account that actually explains exactly what's wrong with the death penalty.
And what does he say? What does he say is wrong with it?
I mean, he doesn't go into his own case. He doesn't plead that he's been dealt an unjust hand. It's that he feels that, apart from his objection to the taking of life in those circumstances, which he feels anyway, he sees it as a wider expression of the injustices of the American legal system, the United States legal system. It pushes him into a circumstance in which he feels, and he's denied all sorts of things, he can't actually get a recording of Strange Fruit to listen to, where he appreciates more fully a whole range of other things, particularly music and song, which he feels strongly about. Mm. And that in a way, is what keeps him sane in a basically insane situation.
Mm, absolutely.
And it is an insane situation.
Mm. Over 90% of all known executions take place in six countries. One of them is China, where 22 people are executed each day. Journalist Sam Gill is a China expert. He's just dropped in for a chat from London. Sam, why are people being executed in China?
Well, the difficulty with that is really that it's a very difficult question to ask because the Chinese court system is still very far from transparent. It's a very politicized court system, although increasingly the profession of lawyer is more autonomous and professionalized and is not a party job as it once was. Still, the court system is very much tied to the Communist Party, which has had a monopoly on power since 1949. And it's very difficult to, for instance, distinguish crimes of dissent against the Communist Party from very real crimes. The real issue is that the court system is actually very unaccountable.
One of the things that astounded me when I was in Beijing about 3 years ago is that China seems to be walking a really interesting line on freedom of speech. On the one hand, I walked into one of the universities there and there was this huge environmental conference going on, some of whose speakers were very critical of the Chinese Communist Party, and I was surprised by that. Then at the same time, of course, anything that threatens the Chinese Communist Party, whether it be somebody talking about the establishment of a party political system or somebody criticising the actual way in which China is dealing with Tibet, those kinds of actions can lead you into a labour camp, can't they, Sam? Can you give us a bit of a rundown about what is safe to say in China and what isn't at the moment?
You're completely right that there is, in some sense, a burgeoning kind of culture of freedom of speech around certain issues. And for instance, environmental politics and the sort of environmental governance issues are in many ways also a way in for a lot of people to talk about a lot of wider issues to do with governance. And like you say, even sometimes things like electoral reform. But there's a line which people have to tread, and it's a very careful one. Mostly it revolves around whether you directly take on the edicts of the central government, which still have a very high place and are very dangerous to criticize, or whether you are more specifically focused on the wrongdoings of local government. There's a really interesting culture of press freedom, particularly at the local level in China, where investigative reporters will expose local corruption, will take on local polluters who are ruining their area, will take on even provincial governors, county heads, and these lower levels of government. I mean, that's something you wouldn't have been able to see 10, 20 years ago, that there's actually a chance for journalists to seek some kind of redress for local people who have been often really hard done by local officials. But what you can't do, as you've alluded to, is really take on issues which impinge on the central government or very directly on their issues. It's still very difficult to report openly about issues that impinge on, for instance, interests in Taiwan. It's very difficult to report openly about the Xinjiang area of northwest China, and of course in Tibet as well. It's still really a no-go area for journalists and for academics who are operating otherwise in a slightly more free environment.
The Olympic Games will be held in Beijing this year, and the Olympic Committee reckons this will improve China's human rights record. Will it?
Well, the Chinese government has come out with some concrete guidelines on how it will improve its human rights situation. So other than its statements, which have all said that it will show greater tolerance for human rights and that there'll be a new face of a opening up developing country in China, they've actually put down very specific guidelines that from the 1st of January 2007 to 17th of September 2008, which is the end of the Paralympics, foreign journalists in particular will have an unprecedented degree of media freedom. And this is a concrete promise that has come from the Chinese government. And so aside from other issues, for instance, the fact that this lifting of restrictions does not apply to Chinese journalists and to the fixers and translators and assistants who, of course, help foreign journalists, nevertheless, there's a concrete promise that foreign journalists will not need to seek advance permission for interviews, for visits away from Beijing, as they have in the past. The problem is that this promise has so far not been met. And so a lot of questions are being raised about really whether we are seeing opening up or whether the International Olympic Committee, for instance, has just accepted these promises without the kind of rigorous questioning that they should have given them.
Yes. Is the Olympic Committee doing anything tangible to monitor the situation?
In comparison to, for instance, the monitoring they've given to environmental issues, which they've been very, very strict on, they really haven't been able to monitor the human rights situation and have been shying away from it at every point. And certainly they haven't had anything to say about the restrictions on media freedom, which have continued since the new guidelines have come into effect. In August last year, more than a dozen journalists were arrested for reporting on a demonstration calling for greater press freedom in Beijing. The BBC correspondent James Reynolds was stopped from reporting on the aftermath of a riot in Hunan province. The military stopped him and said that these new regulations were only for Olympics-related stories. Now, this just wasn't true. These new media regulations are supposed to apply across the board.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because China is the biggest jailer of journalists. What can the internal media expect during the Olympic Games, people reporting with inside the country?
Well, for the media in China, I think what they've seen is something of a test run during October, and this is certainly the way many journalists and editors I've talked to in China understand it, is that during October last year, the Communist Party held its 17th Party Congress. It's a very big show in Beijing, and during this time, there was an almost unprecedented media crackdown. Websites were shut down on a much wider scale than before. Websites were told they had to shut down their forums. Journalists suddenly found themselves unable to report anything but the official news wires. There was one day in particular, which has been pointed out by a number of journalists, that all of the main state newspapers carried the exact same front page because they had actually had strict restrictions that they were to keep to the official Chinese news wire and nothing else. So this almost seemed to be a test run for what's going to happen during the Olympics, which is that there's going to be very, very tight reporting for Chinese journalists, and that questioning anything that's happening in Beijing in terms of what we're actually seeing in terms of a crackdown on dissent, for instance, is not going to be allowed.
I'd like to bring David Ransom into our conversation now, Sam. David, China's done a remarkable job by lifting 200 million of its people out of poverty, or at least that's what it says. Is food on the table the price that must be paid for foregoing human rights such as the ones Sam has been talking about?
Well, that's the way the argument goes, but it's not really one or the other, I don't think. And the time's come in China, as elsewhere, where the two can't be set against each other. It's pretty much as simple as that. Of course, we've talked about the war on terror and its relationship with human rights, but behind all of this is the fact that China is now absolutely central to the whole process of corporate globalization. And that's really a key issue behind why it is that demands of other countries might have made or other people might have made on China in terms of the observation of human rights are being sort of modified. And I don't think those issues can be ignored.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because China is actually dealing with countries without being at all critical of the country's records. I'm thinking here of Sudan, for instance, supplying the government with major arms and not questioning where those arms will be pointed. And Darfur, the conflict in southern Sudan, is a direct response to that. It's interesting that China takes this approach, isn't it? That it doesn't, in terms of its international diplomacy, criticise other countries, and it expects not to be criticised itself. What are your observations about that, David?
Well, it's hard to avoid it. But you've mentioned Darfur, and it's not just internally. I mean, there is the issue of Tibet, but also Burma. Now, when you have a routine situation in which it's not so much failing to criticise those countries, but actually supporting repressive regimes in those countries, then it's hard to see how one can actually observe or should observe the process of refraining from criticism of other countries. I mean, China's not alone in doing that. The Indian government takes a very similar kind of approach very often. But I personally feel that's simply not good enough.
Sam, what's your observations? Do you think that there are any international moves that can be made to help improve China's record on human rights from the outside, or won't they work? Won't it be respected as part of the diplomatic conduct, if you like, that China expects of other countries?
Well, I think what's interesting in the case of Darfur and of China's expansion in Africa and so on, is that this is a story of globalization, as David was saying. I mean, I think what, of course, is interesting is that China, in many ways, is actually acting in Africa in a way that it's been encouraged to by international bodies like the IMF. And in fact, Africa is acting the way that it was encouraged to by the rhetoric of free trade and globalization and so on. So this relationship really has a lot to do with the sort of expansion of globalization, yet China, of course, and Africa both come in for criticism when this happens. So it's actually a difficult one. But I do think that there are some signs that China is moved by diplomatic pressure and that it did appoint an envoy specifically to deal with the Darfur situation. And this came after the Genocide Olympics campaign, this campaign to persuade China to divest from Sudan in time for the Olympics. So there is some sign that China does respond to this kind of diplomatic pressure and will continue to.
That was Sam Gill, a journalist and China expert based in London. Well, thank you so much for being with us on the program today, Sam. Really good to talk with you.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye for now. That was Taraf from the Urban Gypsy CD performed by the Romanian-born Shuka Collective. Gypsy traditions meet modern-day techno beats as the Shuka Collective grab their spoons and wooden barrels to produce dynamic sound. More about that later in the program. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, talking with today's co-host David Ransom. And today we're commemorating the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 23 states that everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favourable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. Yet, around the world, governments are actively working to wind back workers' rights. Tell us about the Syndicate of Workers of Tehran and Suburbs Bus Company, David.
Well, they're a very, very interesting and active group who were originally, after the Iranian Revolution, asked to join a formal trade union but wanted to set up their own and were disbanded in the 1980s. But they've kept going and they are still struggling to exercise their right as trade unionists, which actually also features in the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, Article 8, to which Iran is a subscriber. So what they've been struggling for is simply the right to belong to a trade union, and they've had a series of quite difficult activities since about mid-2005, which have resulted in many of their members being arrested, and certainly one of the most prominent ones, Mansour Ansaloo, in October 2007, was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment for endangering national security. In fact, he's not a well man either, so there are some issues about both the treatment he's received in jail and the kind of medical attention he needs now. So it's an unusual aspect of what's happening in Tehran, but these bus drivers don't mess around, and they're still obviously absolutely determined to exercise their right to belong to a trade union of their choice.
So how are they protesting? How are they letting the government know that they're not happy with the way things are turning out?
Well, they started quite gently by simply driving around with lights on, and 17 of them and more of them got arrested as a result of that. In January 2006, they had a large demonstrations, something like 5,000 of them, went to a demonstration, in this case, to appeal for the release of Mansour Ansaloo, who actually has been arrested on several occasions. This is only the latest time that he's been sentenced, back in October. So they had a major demonstration there. They and many of their families actively picket the prisons where they're held. They protest against the officials who are responsible for holding them. They get a lot of international solidarity as well, a huge list of trade unions and elsewhere in the world, from places you wouldn't necessarily think trade unions were active, like Egypt and Jordan, Kuwait. So they've been an amazingly active group and are still as determined as ever to get what they want, which is their basic human right to belong to a free trade union.
Mm. And just like the stories that Jenny was telling us earlier in the program from Zimbabwe, are doing it through non-violent means, actually just going to the authorities and actually challenging them on the types of action that they're taking in a very fundamental way.
That's absolutely right. These are the kinds of events that are going on in countries all of the time. I mean, Iran keeps hitting the news in the West for all sorts of different reasons. Mm. And the fact that these kinds of things are happening in these countries often get overlooked. And so we've given them a prize for their activities, representative of that fact, amongst many others.
So do you think that the word is getting out through different means in Tehran?
How far it's getting out in Tehran, it's hard to say, although they've obviously had a lot of support. It's hard for them to measure exactly what it is, and so it's hard to say, but certainly in terms of the support they're getting internationally, Mansour Ansaloo himself has become something of an international cause célèbre within the trade union movement. And of course, it's under considerably more pressure in Iran than it is in lots of other places where the right to belong to independent trade unions is very far from recognised by the government.
Let's go now to Moscow and have a chat with Maria Yulukova. Maria has been the Moscow correspondent of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and boy, do they need protection. 14 journalists have been killed because of their work in Russia since Vladimir Putin took the presidency. What do their deaths have in common, Maria?
I think the common thing about all these cases are the ignorance of law enforcement agencies. They have no enthusiasm in trying to solve these cases. What else? All these journalists were killed for their professional work. It's certainly for their articles that they either published already or they were going to publish. Most of them were working on corruption issues. Anna Politkovskaya was working on Chechnya and Chechen local government. And this is why she was killed.
Mm. Anna's death was highly publicised in the international press. Can you remind us, Maria, what Anna was writing about with respect to Chechnya?
Yes, she was mostly writing about human rights violations in Chechnya. And these were the violations of federal government and the forces of federal government. This is why so many people were angry at her. I guess people around Zhan Kadyrov, the president of Chechnya, they were the angriest because they were mostly guilty in all these violations.
Mm. So, Maria, you've been writing about the death of Maxim Maximov. I know that no one will publish it in Russia. We've published it outside Russia in New Internationalist magazine. Can you tell us what's known about how he died and why?
Oh, this is quite a unique case because first he disappeared and no one knew why he disappeared and either he was killed or not. So gradually, law enforcement agencies and his colleagues, they found out how he was killed. But now the suspects in this case, the people who actually killed the journalist, they were just released in late December, I believe. Mm. So it sounds like a dead end in the case. Mm. And I'm trying very hard to publish more pieces on the case. The uniqueness of this case is that in all other cases, there were more family members and more people interested in solving the case. But this is the hardest one, because even a St. Petersburg journalist refused to cover the case.
Really?
Yes.
And
yes.
Why
say
is that?
There is no news on the case. This is why there is no reason to cover it.
Tell us how Maxim Maximov died. What do we know about that? Who killed him?
He was choked to death. Five people were involved in the murder. Three of them, they're from military forces, from law enforcement agencies also. And one of them has high rank position. They choked him to death and they wrapped him into plastic, put him in the car and drove to some forest near St. Petersburg and presumably left the body there. But no one saw the exact place where the body was left because they left their helpers to other men, not from the military forces. They left them on the highway. We don't know if the killers left the body in the forest or they just pretended to do it.
Mm.
Maybe they kept the body in the car and some other day took the body to some other place.
So how do we know how he died then?
We have three witnesses.
So if there are three witnesses, what are investigators doing about it? I mean, that looks like an open and shut murder case, doesn't it?
Yes, totally. I feel totally confused. How come we know how it happened and the killers are still released? Why the court says that they have no ground to charge the suspects? They say, okay, we didn't find the body, but in our laws, there is no law that if you don't have the body, you can charge a killer.
Mm. And so tell us about the process of investigation and adjudication in Russia. Are the courts and are the prosecutors close to the administration, the Putin administration?
Good question. I don't think that any journalist can answer it. We suspect that they are close, but I don't have the proof.
And that's the problem, isn't it? Although 14 journalists...
Yes, it is a big problem, yes. Because some journalists, even if we can find the proof, it's very difficult to publish, to say publicly about this proof.
So although 14 journalists have been killed and their work has been critical of the administration, that alone will be a bold statement to journalists in Russia not to actually take on the Putin administration. How do you think it's affecting the quality of stories about government and administration and scrutiny of government in Moscow at the moment?
I think it is affecting very much because I have a feeling, once again, I don't say it for 100%, but I have a feeling that even our Novaya Gazeta journalists, when they publish very brave and critical articles, they don't say everything they know. And I also know from my own communication with those journalists that there are cases when they feel that they can't say what they know. They're waiting for the right moment.
Mm.
All the time they have to think about consequences of their publications, of their stories.
Indeed, Maria. And I suspect you would have to too. You're writing at the moment about the deaths and Maxim Maximov.
Yes,
what goes through your mind when you're actually publishing this material?
all the time I'm trying to tailor my stories the way that they will be published. Right now, I'm fighting to publish another big story on the case of Maksimov, actually in Novaya Gazeta, and I still couldn't do it. All the time when I talk to editor, I realize that I have to edit it once again, to edit it somehow to make it more smooth. This is what's going on. All the time I have to think how to put it. Because last time I talked to editor, he told me to write an essay on this material. Not just description of the situation, but the essay. And I was really surprised because the material itself is too serious. And I have to source all my statements. And I don't understand why he's asking for an essay. It's a different genre and not for such a serious data.
Indeed. So the Committee to Protect Journalists, what are they saying to the Putin administration that they think needs to happen now in light of the fact that 14 journalists have been killed?
The Committee to Protect Journalists is trying to urge Putin's administration to use its influence in order to investigate all the cases of journalists. They're doing it pretty often, but seems like it doesn't help.
Well, good luck with it, Maria. Thank you so much for joining us today on this program to describe it. It's a phenomenon that I've been looking at with a lot of interest for some time, so it's great to talk with you on the program today. Good luck with your work and stay well.
Thank you.
That was Maria Ulikova, formerly from the Committee to Protect Journalists in Moscow and now at the Carnegie Center. And David Ransom, many thanks for joining our program today. David's just done a magazine that celebrates a range of amazing people and organisations that are winning the human rights race. It's an inspirational read. If you'd like to get a copy, just go to the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Bye for now, David.
Bye, Chris. Good to talk.
And it's time for us to say goodbye to you, too. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is called Urban Gypsy, performed by the Romanian-born Shuka Collective. Their music is Usari, meaning bear tamer or bear handler, which they combine with a techno beat, producing powerful and urgent sounds. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders, if you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website is where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Maher. I'm Chris Richards. Let's chat again next week.